This is the Audacity of Reason. This is Non Sequitur. Season 1, Episode 9. Questioning, a Tale of Concrete Revival. A special interview with street epistemologist, Anthony Mugnabosco. Join in on the discussion and check out upcoming episodes at www.nonsexshow.com. That's NONSEQ show.com. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
We are now joined by Anthony Mugnabosco. I have been practicing all day long, over and over again, how to say epistemology. So I think that I finally have it. It's been tripping me up for the past couple of days, but
you said it perfectly.
I was good. You know what? He didn't even ask for my help on that either. He did it all by himself.
I've been in the mirror all day going epistemology. So
usually people trip over my last name more than anything else.
This is true. So Anthony, kind of give us a little background on yourself and what exactly street epistemology is.
Well, it's funny when you said that you were practicing epistemology. When I went out for the first time 5 years ago to try street epistemology, I had my camera with me and I was talking to it. I had it held up and I was looking at it, and I tripped over the word myself. No, epistemology is the study of knowledge. Street epistemology is a philosophy professor's take on the Socratic method, thinking, hey, maybe if we ask people questions how they could be so sure that their belief is true, it might help them reflect on their belief. Examining the method that a person used to be so sure that their belief is true. So he wrote this book. People started going out and uploading examples where they were doing this on the street. You don't have to go out on the street and do these talks. You can just wait for them to happen. But I needed examples. There weren't examples out there. So I went out with my camera and I could barely even pronounce the word epistemology. And I barely even knew what street epistemology was. But I thought, well, let me just try this, because I was arguing and debating with believers. And I thought this might be a more effective way in helping a person reflect on a deeply held belief. And it turns out that it seems like it might actually be working. It seems like it actually might be an effective tool.
I've seen several videos, and it's a stark contrast, I think, to what people are used to seeing on YouTube. You know, they're used to seeing the contentious, you know, I'm right, you're wrong kind of thing. And your videos seem to take on a different aspect. They're more like a conversation, and everything's civil. You know, so I think that you're right in a way that kind of can break through to people. What would you say that your rate is? I'm trying to think of how to word this, but your rate of, I don't want to say conversion, but where you can tell that you're getting through and that they might be questioning kind of what they believed before talking to you.
Oh, that's a good question. This might sound terribly cocky, but I'm not tracking it for one thing. And sure. So if the parameter is that a person slowed down to think about their belief and started questioning, then it's probably 75%. Like, I think it's very, very high.
Oh, wow.
And you're right. Like, I'm not arguing with them. I'm not debating with them. And while I'd like to say that these are conversations, sometimes they don't really go like a back and forth conversation like we're having. Sometimes they're a little more directed, like, let me ask you a whole bunch of questions in 5 or 10 minutes and let's really explore your belief. It doesn't often allow for a back and forth, but there's nothing saying that you can't do that. But yeah, I think if a person is using street epistemology and they're using Socratic questions to gently challenge how a person can be so sure that their belief is true, and you focus on the method that they used, very, very high percentage of those people, I think, slow down and they think about their belief and they end up walking away thinking about it more. Yeah.
So what would you take us through kind of your method? Like, when you go out, how do you kind of size up who you're going to talk to? And once you get that particular individual scoped out, I guess, how do you approach it from there, and what's the kind of methodology that you take from that point on?
Okay. Let me just preface that by saying, Kyle, that the approach that I use is not like the suggested or recommended. It's just what I'm comfortable doing. It's something sure. that has sort of been honed over the years, and it may not even be optimal. I don't even know. Like, so what I do, for those that don't know, I walk around with a whiteboard with a little marker and a timer, and I ask people if they can chat for 5 minutes. So I'm stopping strangers that tend to look fairly friendly and that they might have some time to kill. So right then and there, I'm probably selectively picking people. People have the option to agree or not. I don't force anybody. If they say, nah, F you, man, I don't want to talk to you. or like, what are you selling? I've had people just like, they're just very defensive right from the get-go. But I try to explain what I'm doing. I'm asking questions to pick a belief. I want to pick a belief that you really think is true. I want to ask you some questions to challenge how you could be so sure. And you might end up walking away thinking about your belief more than you ever have before. That's usually the approach that I take. That's maybe not the optimal approach. Maybe I can go a little further in explaining what I do, but that's kind of what I do. And in my area of this country, it's not unusual for people to stop and agree to talk to me and even let me film it, which is really fascinating because now I have examples to show people and they can point out something that I did wrong or something that they think that I did right. And I can end up improving on it because there are now video examples to look at.
How much feedback do you get from the people that you have these conversations with? I mean, obviously, I've seen you give out your card, your email, your contact information. What is the response rate from them to contact you in the future in regards to the interview that you had with them or the street epistemology that you had with them?
I don't track it. But if I had to – no, I don't, because sometimes I forget to give a person a card or – I might give them a card or ask them to take a picture of it. Like, I'm not consistent in how I deliver the contact information. Sometimes I completely forget. But for the people that I give a card to, whether the talk goes well or not, I still give people a card because I want feedback. I would guess 5% of the people, maybe 10, message me for something to say, where's that footage going? Or can we meet again? Or, you know, that definition of faith that I gave you, I thought about it and that wasn't really the best definition. And I'd like to meet with you again so we can go over it some more. Or
they want a redo.
They want a redo.
That's
yeah.
Nice. That's actually good.
I think so. Yeah. So that kind of happens a lot where people, I think they end up reflecting on the conversation, which in it of itself is good.
Sure.
And they might
have a win right there. Is it not?
Hell yeah, it is. Yeah. Yes, I think it is. And then they tend to think, oh, I could have answered that so much better. And then they want to meet again to correct the record. And I'm totally for that. I want to have a complete, full, accurate understanding of what they believe. So I'll often meet with a person again. Sometimes I get it on camera. That's ideal. And we can have another talk. So I'm not tracking it, but it's not unusual for me to get a message from somebody that I've talked to sometimes years after the fact.
That's incredible, I think, because going back to what we started with initially, anytime you see the debates where you have the contentious example where they're kind of going back and forth, you never see one where they walk away, where one party walks away going, you know what, you had a point. It's always either they hate quit or, you know, they're out of there. You always end on those kind of – and I wonder sometimes if the ultimate goal between debates is really to – try to get through to them, or if it's just a shouting match, you know,
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I think the purpose of a debate, whether the participants in the debate know it or not, is to influence the watchers, not the person that you're talking to.
I agree with that one. Yeah.
So like the debate last night was it last night or 2 nights ago? The one with Arn and Kent.
Discussion.
They were.
It was a discussion.
It feels like.
I saw it.
I can't let that one
call
go.
It's it what you will.
I got corrected for that too. Don't worry. But I made the mistake of doing it in front of Arn. So that he was quick to. Okay. Not a debate.
Not a debate, damn it.
Exactly.
But he sure as hell enjoyed himself. I have.
Oh, if it was a debate, he would have enjoyed it just as much. So. Okay, but go ahead.
Call it what you will. I think my point was that Kent is not probably at home thinking about the compelling argument that Arn made for evolution.
Definitely not.
Not
but close. There are people that were probably watching that were stunned to see Kent struggle to answer something or possibly dodge to abiogenesis and think about the things that Arn was saying. And there may even be some atheists that were compelled by Kent's argument. I don't know. I mean, it's entirely possible.
Anthony.
But typically discussions like that, let's go with discussions, tend to be more beneficial to the people that are observing it, not the ones. And that's what I like about SE, street epistemology, is that when you're in a one-on-one conversation, which is what most of us find ourselves in, we're having one-on-one talks with our aunt, our friend, our coworker, our parent. Having a heated discussion usually tends to jeopardize the relationship, and it doesn't cause a person to reflect on their belief. But SE, and you can see it in the videos, people slow down. They reflect. They take some time to really think about what they believe, the reasons why, and the method they used. And you rarely see that when people are going head to head on a YouTube video arguing about evolution or something like that.
That's true. While we're talking about Aaron, and we brought this up with when we did his interview, but you actually got Aaron to come out and practice street epistemology. How did he do?
I think Aaron fully exceeded my expectations. By coming out, he drove from Dallas to San Antonio. The weather was shitty the first day. We went out the second day. It was windy. We got a lot of heat for the quality of the audio on that video. But we were kind of down to the wire. We had to do with what we had. And he was honestly willing to listen to what I was saying, to take the teachings that I was giving him. And he did go out and try SE. He really did. He gave it his all. And then when we were done, he would listen to what I was saying. And I think he would try to incorporate the teachings that – and I was thinking about this today, actually, for some reason. Maybe it was because of watching Aaron with Kent, that I was thinking that I probably could have done a better job of explaining where he could have improved. I think it was my first time going out and teaching somebody like how to do this. Sure. So it was a learning experience for both of us, I think. And I thought he did great. And if you like that video and you would really like to see Aaron give it a try again, I will go up to Dallas, or maybe he can come out here again and we can give it a second go.
I think that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, I think we should encourage that. Yeah.
I think it'd be fun.
We'll link that video too down in the description so that people can check that out and also express their interest to see Aaron back there. But do you get any do you ever get any kind of pushback from anyone that you come in contact with? Like, is there ever a sort of confrontation or people that just maybe you kind of get into their brain a little bit too much and they get really defensive and try to close it off? And how do you deal with that?
Sometimes I meet people who I don't even interview them, and they just want to know what I'm out there doing. And then when I explain that I'm questioning people about a deeply held belief, then they get really irate. They say, well, wait a second, are you an atheist or something? And then it's just curious how defensive some people will get. Very rarely do I talk to somebody and we chat for 5 or 10 minutes and they're upset with me. That barely ever happens. And if it did, I probably was not using street epistemology. I was probably getting sloppy. I was probably providing them with evidence to show that they were mistaken, or I might have been laughing maybe at something kind of that we might find ridiculous as skeptics possibly. So usually if somebody is irate with me, it's because of something that I've done. That's not always the case. Sometimes people there are some people that get thrown for a loop because they've never really analyzed their belief before. And then they discover, oh my gosh, I only think that this thing is true because I was taught it. Or I want it to be true, and therefore it's true to me for some reason. And then that discovery is a little jarring for people. So yes, it does happen, but I think it's all in how you carry yourself and how you try to make yourself available after the talk too, which is one of the reasons why some people will reach out, is they're like, damn, I need to talk to somebody. Can we talk again? Or can you direct me to some resources where I can see how people who don't believe in any gods cope with reality? How do they cope without a God belief? Because I might be in that category now.
Do you find it to be unfortunate that, like, when somebody has approached you or you approach them and the first thing they say is, you know, well, you're an atheist? I mean, obviously, this is an approach that has nothing really to do with atheism per se. This is an approach that anybody can use. I know theists that are willing to take this approach and use street epistemology because they want to see, again, to challenge people's beliefs and see why people believe what they do. So do you want to avoid that stigma that street epistemology is somehow intricately related to atheism?
I would love to get rid of that stigma, but it's difficult because the book that started this is called A Manual for Creating Atheists. Fortunately, the author himself has come around on this idea that street epistemology should just be for atheists challenging theists. Most of the videos on my channel these days are, and I ask people to pick the topic, and they typically pick a supernatural thing, but it's not always God. They'll pick karma. They'll pick everything happens for a reason. They'll pick The Secret or something else. And we still have the same type of chat, but it's not about a God belief. So yeah, there's two misconceptions. One is that you're proselytizing like a street preacher because of the word street, I think, in the word, and that the examples that are out there are people on the street. And then the second one is that, yes, this is only for atheists to challenge God believers. And there's nothing further from the truth. I would love to see God believers learn this method and like have a Muslim interview a Mormon why they think that their belief is true. And then that Mormon using the same approach with that Muslim, I think, would just be perfect.
That's interesting. I don't mean to put either one of you on the spot, but I want to do kind of an experiment. I want to pretend that you just met Steve and take us through. Steve, pick a deeply held belief that you have, and let's see an example of how street epistemology works. I think this would be fascinating.
Well, that's kind of a difficult way to go. I mean, we all have our beliefs, and I mean, my beliefs are also some of my knowledge, right? I mean, if you take the approach that if you have a deeply held belief, like I believe the universe exists, that's a deeply held belief that I have. It's something that I cannot demonstrate, cannot prove. I have to take axiomatically. But I don't know if something like that would be along the lines would be of interest for street epistemologists to go down.
Let me just put it this way. Number one, there are hundreds of examples on my YouTube channel and other people's YouTube channels where you can see this happen, where we're not pretending, for one thing. And the second thing I want to point out is that if you just think of this model, and I could share my screen and show you this little triangle thing that I have, or maybe send it to you afterwards, but picture a triangle where it's broken up into thirds. And the top third of that, which is the smallest piece, says belief. And then the center part of that says reasons. And the third bottom part, the largest part of the pyramid, says method. Whether we're questioning some random on the street about God or talking to Steve about reality or how we can know things or whatever, you do want to start with what the person believes. You want to identify the reasons. You want to validate and make sure that those really are the reasons by asking something like, if that could be explained to your satisfaction, would you still be just as confident that the belief is true? And if they say yes, then there's some other reason propping up the belief. So you figure out what is the reason that drives the confidence behind the belief. And then after that is the third and most important part, and I think it's the method. Did you use a reliable method to conclude that Muhammad flew to heaven on a winged horse? And then if they realize that they've used an unreliable method, you circle back to the top of that, right to the belief again, and you ask them, are you still just as confident that that belief is true? If you follow that general template, that seems to be extremely effective in helping a person slow down and reflect on the belief that they hold. So while it would be tempting to go ahead and like role play something or even do one, I'm always a little reluctant to do that, honestly, because if it doesn't go well,
that's fair.
Yeah, let's say it doesn't. Yeah, I mean, I've just outlined the schematic of how to do it. Sure. Give that a try.
I think what's more important is actually be on the same page as far as what we're talking about is the words, like the word to believe, or like, for example, you might use it slightly different than I might use it. And I think that needs to be clarified initially going into a conversation. Like I use the word to believe or the phrase believe to mean that my theory of justification is such that I'm a foundationist. I take properly basic beliefs axiomatically. Not everybody's going to do that. Some people could be reformed epistemologists. Some people could be infinitism, or a few other things they could be. Now, when you go and you do these street epistemology things, you're not obviously dealing with people that are well-versed in epistemology. You're not dealing with people right. that have a well-formed theory of justification, theory of knowledge, theory of truth. So if you say, well, how do you know something? They're not going to go back to you and tell you, well, P is true, S believes P, right. and P is justified P. I mean, they're not going to have that kind
well,
of
also, there's a flip side of that. I'm in the same boat. I've never been formally trained in academic epistemology or philosophy or psychology. If I had to go back to school, I think I'd go back to study psychology, because it seems like that's what's really going on behind these beliefs. So yes, I'm a layman going out and using layman terms, talking to laymen about beliefs that they hold. Rarely do I encounter somebody who is a theologian, or they've studied philosophy for 20 years or something like that. These are just very basic conversations to encourage a person to slow down and think about their belief formation process. That's essentially all there is to it. Now, that journey tends to result in a person questioning their belief or doubting even. And I think that's a healthy thing. So, yes, I'm not an expert in any of these areas. I'm often asked, how do you justify going out there if you're not like trained in this? This is the whole point of Boghossian's book, is to give people just enough skills to go out and have a talk and watch my videos.
They're great. They're absolutely great. I've binge watched your videos.
Thank you.
They're fantastic.
They are.
They might be a little slow, a little boring as opposed to a heated discussion, but they are fucking incredible in terms of the mechanics of a belief, the psychology behind it, the emotion that is tied to these beliefs. There's something really incredible about this, and we're not still entirely sure what it is that we're doing with it, where we're going with it. We're in the very, very early stages of this, and I'm so excited to be like a part of this community to see where it goes and where we might be in 5 years or so.
A part, you're kind of more than a part. When people say street epistemology, I mean, you come to mind. You kind of are the center, I think, on at least online, the YouTube wise. Like you are the. Is that kind of a big burden to have, being kind of looked to as the Mr. Street Epistemology, I guess you would say?
Sometimes it's a little ego boosting, you know, to be honest. Like, hey, we have a street epistemology question. Let's go to Anthony and ask him, because he does this a lot. And then on the other hand, you get a lot of grief from people who are worried about this method, or they think it's disingenuous, or that you're not qualified enough to have a talk. So then I'm also the go-to guy for that criticism. So it does get on you a little bit, to be frank. But I remind myself of the progress that I can make with somebody on the street. And they tell me how great of a time that they had, and that this was a profound experience having a chat with me about some deeply held belief that they've held. So the benefit of it seems to far outweigh the criticism, but I'm not against hearing criticism. I mean, I encourage it. I welcome that.
And I can tell you that from experience, when I first heard of this, I actually emailed you. I mean, I knew who you were, and we've talked before. And I expressed some criticism that I had, and I got to tell you, it was dealt with professionally. It was dealt with, you know, quickly and resolved. And I was like, this is fine. I mean,
but, good.
Yeah, no, I've talked to you and a few other people, as we know, mutual friend Ozzy. And I think all the criticisms I and other people had in the group that I was with for the most part, was resolved. I mean, the only thing possibly left somebody has said, and I disagree with him on this. I do not think you have to be an expert in any of these fields to go talk to anybody. That's just anybody can have a conversation with anybody.
Well, to be clear, I don't think Ozzy was making that case either. Was that what you were saying?
No, okay. not at all. No, I actually.
Oh, other people.
I went to him. Other people, and I went to him with my concerns.
Yeah, we have another podcast, and I was we had asked Ozzy that same question. do you have to be qualified to do this? And it seemed like he was of the position that no, like anybody can ask a person.
Right, that's
a question.
And I believe that very strongly. And the other criticism, you know, some people may say it's kind of predatory, and I don't think that it is at all. Your goal is not to you know, change everybody to your position and make everybody think exactly the way you think. Your goal is to have conversations and make people, you know, just kind of question what they believe. I find nothing wrong with that. I do the same thing, and I'm not even a street epistemologist. So
it's a conversation. You
know. Yeah, it does frustrate me when I hear those criticisms that it's predatory or we're taking advantage of people. And yet that feedback is helping us hone the technique, okay, the method. So yeah, there was a criticism. You're only picking on people who are ill prepared to believe in a God. So we started talking to other people who are maybe more trained in that. Or and now I ask people to, like, can you please pick a belief? I'm not even necessarily interested in the God one. I'll talk about whatever belief that they hold. So what I find interesting about the criticism from people who say these people are ill prepared to handle these types of conversations, they're the same people that don't criticize the believer for holding the belief. I'm okay if Jane over there believes that Jesus is God, but she's certainly not qualified to defend her position.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that bugs me a little bit.
Yeah,
that.
I could see that. Yeah. Why I would. I mean, look, at any kind of belief you have, I believe that people should be able to defend it in some ways. They may not be articulate enough to do it, but I mean, to say that I have this belief and I'm going to go around telling anybody that my belief is correct, I have an onus to have some kind of, I hate to use the word evidence because it's used, I think, inappropriately sometimes, but you have to have some kind of information as to warrant your belief on something. You can't just say, I believe this. You need to believe the way I believe, but I'm not going to give you any reason as to why you need to believe the way I believe. That makes no sense to me. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not.
Right. There should always be some sort of justification for the belief, even if it's, yeah, I guess I was raised with it and I've never really thought about why I have it. Okay. That's acceptable. It's probably not a good reason to really believe very strongly that something is true. But no. You encounter that enough, and I have beliefs like that too. There are many, many things that are in my mind that I just believing because I overheard it, I saw something, and I think it's true. But if I was asked about it, it would cause me to probably reflect on it and maybe lower my confidence in it.
Absolutely.
How do you fit all this into 5 minutes?
You broke up just a bit.
How do you fit all of this into 5 minutes, especially when you were going through the pyramid? Like, how do you go through all of those steps realistically in 5 minutes? I mean, that's impressive.
There's a lot more to it than that. You have to build a little rapport. You have to make the person feel comfortable. You have to explain what you're up to. You want to give them a way to contact you at the end. You might have to deal with an interruption or something when their cell phone goes off. So there's way more to it than just, what do you believe? Why and how can you be so sure? But 5 minutes is really all you need, honestly.
they tend to run over, though. Most of the ones I've seen tend to run over.
Yeah, yeah. So. If you go through my videos, you'll probably find two that are 5 minutes long, and those are probably just little quick clips that I've created just for people who are attention. What's the word I'm looking for?
Why for me? Attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, like. Yeah. I just can't focus on anything that's more than 3 minutes long. Okay, there are examples out there for you. So the point of those is to get you excited, like, oh, wow, that was really interesting. I'm going to see a longer talk. So, yeah,
teaser.
The average talk that I have is probably 15 minutes.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So the 5 minutes gets a person interested. It shows that I'm respecting their time. It's an out for me if the person is not being honest with me or they're, you know, you can usually get a sense of this person isn't into this talk. They're just too defensive. They're not willing to open up. They're freaked out about the cameras, or they're mumbling, or maybe they have a really strong accent and it's just not going to play well, that type of thing. So yeah, but usually when the 5 minute timer goes off, my interlocutor barely notices. And if they do, they're like, they wave it off. Oh, that's okay. Let's keep going. And then we talk for another 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, very few cut off exactly 5 minutes. I mean, I don't even remember seeing one where they said, oh, time's up, I'm out of here. They usually want to continue the conversation, I think.
What's interesting is these days, and I say that sort of with a caveat because I haven't been out in a few months because I've been busy with interviews and giving talks and stuff. But these days, I have even forgotten to set the timer.
Oh, that's cool.
It's kind of like a prop at this point.
it's almost like a little bit of a prop, to be quite frank. Like, but this guy's going to respect my time. And sometimes people will tap on my board. You didn't set the timer yet. What's going on? So I've even had some people say, I can't do five, but I could do three. Let's do three. So yeah, the timer is somewhat of a prop, but it's a freaking good one because it conveys so much all at once, you know?
Yeah, it's very good. One,
what's the future that you see? What kind of direction do you want to take this in? And what are your plans do you have coming up now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Ooh, man, I got a lot of irons in the fire. Off the top of my head, I'd say normalizing street epistemology so that the knee-jerk response of, oh my gosh, this is just as bad as the proselytizing street preacher. I think we're getting past that. You know, a lot of the influencers in the atheist movement, I think, are learning street epistemology. They're understanding it. They may occasionally practice it or incorporate it into a talk or a phone call that they're having with a theist or something like that. So normalizing SE, I think, is a big part of it. Promoting it as much as possible, which is why I love coming on shows like yours to get the word out. Showing that it's not just for atheism is big. I think there's a huge untapped market to try this with political beliefs. We've started we have a logo for it. We're going to, you know, sell a few little knickknacks and things, coffee mugs, just so we have some money to fund the efforts that have been largely taken on by volunteers, just paying it out of their pocket to fly to Missouri to give a talk to the SSA or something like that. So it'd be nice to be able to have some funding behind it. Possibly creating an organization like a street epistemology org where we have some transparency on the money flowing in and out. Teaching theists this method. This is not something that is just for an atheist to challenge or a skeptical person for that matter to challenge people about supernatural beliefs. We want everybody to learn it. This is an equal opportunity tool and sort of just take the fear and misunderstanding out of it, I think is kind of where we're at right now. And then eventually I want to see people studying this in a formal setting where you have, here's my dream. You have 5,000 college students who are going through a street epistemology type of conversation, for lack of a better word, whether it's through a computer or it's paper-based, or these are actually one-on-one conversations with facilitators and somebody studying it, what's happening in these talks, what's possibly even happening in their brain. That's kind of where I'd like to see it go. And I want to see it taught to kids too. I want children to be learning these methods at an early age so that they're questioning their parents, they're questioning their teachers, they're questioning.
Oh, you really want to do that? You can have a bunch
damn right
of parents
thanking
you.
It literally could be taught side by side with things such as like critical thinking, things such as contemporary rhetoric, things such as learning logical fallacies. I think that this would actually work out well with some kind of combined classes in contemporary rhetoric understanding. So, yeah, I don't see why it wouldn't migrate to a college level at some point.
Oh, I'm talking younger than college even. There's a good chance that I might be
younger.
Yeah, sure. Like camp. This is perfect for a Camp Quest, you know, secular camp type of training type of thing. I think it would be great.
I think they should teach critical thinking. You know, in a grade school. I mean, it should be from almost like day one.
Yes, I think so. And it's perplexing why that hasn't happened.
I have absolutely no idea. I really don't get it. Matter of fact, I'll be honest. A lot of things I learned about critical thinking, I did not even know about until I went to college.
Yeah.
And that was a shame. I mean, have I had those tools earlier on, I think I would have been much further ahead in my academics.
That's how I see street epistemology. I see it as a tool set. Yes, it's a great dialectical to challenge a person's deeply held belief. And in a 5 or 10 minute talk, I'm nearly certain that you will probably be less certain in what you believe if you have a chat with me and I'm using this method and you're being honest with yourself. But better, like, yes, that's great if I can challenge a deeply held belief and you go away thinking about it and you might even like adjust your confidence up or down. But if you go home and you think about the questioning that I used and you say, oh my gosh, I want to learn how to do that. That's even better. So street epistemology more these days for me has become a lot more about saying, let me demonstrate how this tool, it's almost like a vacuum salesman or something. Let me demonstrate how this tool works. Look at how it gets all the dirt off. Isn't that great? Now take it, take it home and yes. Vacuum your carpets. So yeah, that's kind of where I think we're at right now is that we're becoming very proficient with the technique. We're realizing how effective it is. There's a whole, I didn't even mention this, but there's a whole aftercare component to this that I think is very important too, where there are communities of people who have gone through this and they know what it's like to be kind of shooken up about a deeply held belief. And they're there for you to listen, you know, to catch you when you fall. This thing is like, it's exploding and it's going into all these different directions and it's been quite overwhelming. But it has been an amazing, amazing journey so far. And nothing gets me, other than talking about my family, nothing more excites me these days than trying to get really, really good at this and trying to tell as many people as possible about it.
That was my next question. How large is the street epistemology community now? Like, can you kind of gauge, you know, are they evenly spread throughout the states? Is there like regions that are, you know, it's pocketed more? What's the community like now?
I'm only going off of Facebook group postings and requests to sign up to a Facebook group. There is a map on the streetepistemology.com website. You can create an account and you can put a little push pin into where, you know, where you are. I think if I were to pull up that map, it would probably almost always probably almost all be North America with little smatterings, you know, internationally. But I don't think that that's a good representation. Going off of the types of people who are requesting to join some of the Facebook groups, the street epistemology Facebook groups, my guess is 60% North America and then 40% the rest of the world. It seems to be a fairly international thing.
And what's the demographic like as far as age-wise? Like, are you seeing younger younger individuals that are more interested? Is it kind of mid-range? What's the – and women, men, what's it kind of separated out like that?
I think – it's probably safe to say that it's more men than women, mm-hmm. and maybe slightly older men. Okay. See, this is so talk about like a epistemology. I'm going off of sort of my observation, and maybe I'm just only noticing men my age, you know, that type of thing.
Sure.
Maybe men my age are more comfortable reaching out to me, and then I'm getting skewed somehow. So I don't know, but if I had a guess, I'd say 5,000 to 10,000 people are aware of SE and have probably used it at one point in their life or another.
That's great. Those are great numbers.
Yeah, that's really high.
So where can people go to learn more, sign up, donate, give us all of those kind of places they can go to find out more?
Okay, so right now there's no place to donate any money, and we don't want people to. Somebody sent me $100 via PayPal, and I don't even recognize his name. He wanted to support me in some way. I'm saving that money, and any money that we get from selling T-shirts or coffee mugs or whatever with the logo on it, we're saving that until we actually have an organization to collect funds so that we can – let's say that there's somebody who wants to give a talk, but they have to incur $700 for travel expenses. They could reach out – hypothetically, they can reach out to the organization. We can investigate it and give them money to make that happen. So don't send money to anyone at this point at all, other than maybe content creators like yourself who are helping us get the word out.
I think you're the only person that we've interviewed that it says don't send us money.
Don't pay me. Yeah. Send you guys the money instead of us.
The award.
Only because we don't have a place to put it, really. Now, what's interesting is so many people were asking me to come give talks on street epistemology because they're excited about it. I did a fundraiser and we ended up raising, I asked for $4,000 and 3 days later we had close to $5,000. So that
wow.
was great. That's helping me get to four different events, two of which have happened and two are coming up. So people are interested. They have money on the sidelines. I'm just asking people hold off on that until we have something transparent and legit that you can put your money to.
The money will
there was another part of your question, but I can't remember what it was.
where they can go to like find out more. Like, what's your website, your Facebook group,
that kind of thing. Thank you. Go to streetepistemology.com. If you go to community, I think there's a link, or resources, you'll find links to the book that started all this, a guide that we created for people. It's like a 30-page guide that teaches you how to do this. There's links to not only my YouTube channel, but other people's YouTube channels who are doing this. There's great content coming out from a channel called Street Knowledge, another one called Cordial Curiosity, another one called Deep Discussions, another one called Pine Creek.
And Pine Creek is awesome.
Pine Creek is awesome.
I like Cordial Curiosity myself.
Cordial Curiosity is great. And here's where, like, street epistemology should not just be about one person. It's not about Peter Boghossian. It's not about Anthony Magnabosco. It's not about Reed from Cordial Curiosity. These are just people who Peter had this idea. People have started doing it, like myself. This isn't not a method that's like, I didn't start this. I'm merely trying to perfect it, for lack of a better word, and promote it. That's kind of where we're at. I want people to be focused on the method rather than individuals in it, because then there tends to become this mentality of, Anthony said that you shouldn't do that, so we shouldn't do that anymore. Like, there are no real leaders in this community. There are people who are, I guess, prominent and putting out lots of examples, but I don't dictate what street epistemology is.
You wanted to grow organically rather than some kind of a top down type of thing.
Preferably. Yeah. Because let's say I get arrested for something, like the future of street epistemology should not rest on the future, you know, like my behavior, right? Like this is just something that everyone, it's a tool. And how I conduct myself should really not have any bearing on how this tool gets popularized. So I'm always a little worried about that.
Unfortunately, very rarely do you get to decide that. You know, that's the unfortunate thing. It's decided by the public, and right now it says that you are the
the go-to guy,
the face of street epistemology. I think, because when you say street epistemology, I mean just subconsciously, I think Anthony, you know, that's just what pops in my head. It's hard, I think, I understand where you're coming from, like, and I see your side that you don't want to be the center, but ultimately somebody has to be, I think, kind of like the leader of a movement. And
thank you, man. There's a great video, and I like to play it every once in a while. And I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's called like Dancing Lessons from, I don't know, leadership development or something. I can't think of the title, but it's about this guy who's kind of dancing. Yeah. I'll have to look it up. I think it's one of my favorite YouTube videos. I don't know where I was going with that, but basically it's this guy dancing kind of crazy. Somebody mimics him, but kind of puts a little bit of a twist on it. And then a third person comes up and they're dancing. And then before you know it, like the whole crowd is rushing in and they're doing all these kind of wild, but different dances. And that's kind of how I like to see this method. It's always great to see people wanting to go out and do street epistemology, whether they film it or they're just doing it organically. But when you see somebody copying me or Reed exactly, I get a little worried about it. I understand that it might make a person feel comfortable to mimic, but you don't want to copy. Don't copy so much where you're not being yourself. The key to SE is to be honest with yourself and be honest with your conversation partner.
You're kind of giving them the template, and then they're using it and they're adding their own little way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote a blog post that's on the SE website under blogs called Pitching the Script, where I talk about the pros and the cons of going out and viewing street epistemology as some sort of script that can just be easily copied. Like, I think there's some advantages to it. Somebody who may never have a talk might do one because they've watched 30 videos. But if you're going to upload content, put your own unique spin on it so it doesn't appear disingenuous.
Kind of like the Non Sequitur show does, right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't seen enough of your episodes yet. How many episodes
are out? Hey, what are you doing, man?
We're at well, number nine, we just, oh, no, we're at number eight, nine. But we have about three, four, five more that are in backlog.
We're backed up.
We're backed up. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're quite backed up.
Damn. Yeah, that's the thing. I don't listen to any music anymore. There's so much good content. There's so many good podcasts, and there's so many good SE videos out there too. And it's interesting to see people who might have normally debated, and you find that they're asking more Socratic questions. And I'm wondering, did SE influence that in any way? Did they maybe watch a video of Reed's or myself or something, or did they maybe read Peter's book? Like, that's really interesting that they're taking more of a Socratic friendly approach there.
That's a cool that's got to be a cool feeling to have, too. I noticed that you also do a podcast with several other street epistemologists.
You started off so well with it, Kyle.
I told you I was going to crack.
You did it. You did it. You managed, though.
Yes. Yes, I do a podcast with Reed from Cordial Curiosity, and we have a co-host who he's busy with school, but he's interesting. His name is Daniel, in that I met him on a college campus when I was doing street epistemology about 2.5 years ago, and he was a theist who worked for an on-campus college ministry promoting the good news of Jesus Christ. And that conversation was a small factor in his journey towards non-belief. And he is actually a co-host on our show. So, yeah, he has a really interesting perspective, because not only is he learning SE, he experienced it firsthand as a believer. He's one of those people who enjoyed it a lot, never forgot the conversation, reached out to me 2 years later, and then met me again for a follow-up, but then expressed an interest to learn street epistemology. And I ended up giving him one of my GoPro cameras as sort of like a, you know, passing of the torch type of thing. But yeah, that show is called Epistemic. I think we're like at our 12th episode now too. But we like to bring people on who are really focused on SE, whether they're into linguistics or philosophy, psychology, they're just getting started out, or they might even have a criticism of SE. Then we try to bring them on and hash it out.
That's got to make it all worth it when you have events like what you just described happen, where you have somebody that can actually, it's living proof that it works. Yeah. You know, I mean, that it's a thing that works.
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody that's had a debate with someone come back and say, yeah, we got into it about 6 months ago, but he came back and said, you know what? You were right. That very,
Steve?
Almost never happened.
I've had it happen. On my debate with Wayne on Mac Revolution, he did come back a few weeks later and said I was right, and he actually left Young Earth Creationism. So it can happen.
Hmm. Yeah. Here's the thing. With street epistemology, you want to try to meet a person where they're at. So part of the what, why, and how is getting an assessment of where they are. Are they emotionally dependent on the belief? Do they have evidence for the belief? Would evidence change their mind? Is this belief based on something other than evidence, like maybe faith? So you want to ask questions to pull this out of a person. Help me understand as best as you can why you think that this is true and how you determine that it's the case. And yeah, you may find that this person is believing in something because they think they have evidence, and they might be compelled to lower their confidence in the belief or completely abandon that belief if you were to provide them evidence. So there are some people that say that they're evidence-based and they really mean it. In my experience, though, when a person says that they're evidence-based, they're almost always not. There's usually, especially on a supernatural claim, they're almost always basing the belief on something unreliable, some unreliable foundation.
Sure. Okay, Anthony, last question before we let you go.
Yeah.
What is the one quote that you live by?
The one quote that I live by is something that I had on a t-shirt a while ago. Damn, there's like two of them now because I'm thinking of Dillahunty's great quote.
You can give us two.
Well, Dillahunty's quote, I want to believe as many true things and as few false things as possible, is up there. But my first answer to that would be question everything, worship nothing.
Oh, that's good.
I love that. Really good. I love that philosophy. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with questioning things. Questioning is a virtue, I think. And believing something based on an unreliable foundation is not virtuous. So sure. That's kind of my go-to. I love those quotes.
And while you're listening, speaking of Matt Dillahunty, we will be having him April the 24th.
Join us. Okay. You know, that reminds me, Matt is going to be at NanoCon. I'll be there too. We'll be giving two workshops on street epistemology. I'll be giving a talk. And then also at American Atheist, I'll be there. So this, I'm thinking maybe this will come out. Maybe this will come out after those events. I'm not sure. But if you weren't at NanoCon March 17th, and if you weren't at American Atheist on March 30th through the 1st of April, then you've probably missed something really great.
This will be out Saturday. So
we'll queue this one up. We'll put it to the front of the line. And did you get a chance to listen to Pam from American Atheist that we had on? Because if not, I'll definitely send you those links to that particular podcast because it was amazing.
You have to.
It was
okay. We do a new segment with their membership chair, Pamela Whistle, where we play the angry voicemails and read the angry emails that they get hilarious. At American Atheists. And they are classic.
I have not heard that, but I'm going to listen to it. I'll listen to it tonight.
Awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, are you excited about seeing Hugh Laurie?
Okay. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I never watched House.
Oh
yeah, sorry. I'm losing my atheist cred here.
Minus one cool point, but I still think you're amazing. That's okay.
Would you rather I pretend?
No,
I mean, I'd rather be honest with you. I don't know much about him other than some of the cool quotes. I see the character that he plays show up on.
Oh yeah,
he was amazing. Yeah.
So other than that, I don't really know. I'm looking forward to meeting him. I think it'd be great. I mean, there might be some advantages of he may be sitting in the crowd while I'm giving a 45-minute talk on street epistemology to this group. So I think there could be some advantages there. Maybe, you know, make some contacts, that type of thing. But I don't know really that much about him, fortunately.
I just had the greatest vision in my head of seeing House MD on the street doing street epistemology.
Oh my God, that'd be your biggest video of all time. Make it happen.
You know, my daughter's really into Netflix and I've been telling her, you know, you should check out House. I've heard some good things about that, but as far as I know, she hasn't pulled it up yet, but I've been meaning to watch it. I haven't watched it yet.
It's amazing. Well, Anthony, Steve and I appreciate you joining us. This was a fantastic interview. So happy to help you spread the word of street epistemology. That would be the, I think I did pretty well for
we're going to work on this.
Even you nailed it every time. I don't know what you're talking about. You've been great. No, thank you for inviting me on the show. And you guys are doing great things. There are people who are they're coming across my content, your content. My style may not appeal to them. Your style might, or vice versa. And it's great. I think I love what you guys are doing, and just keep it up. And I'll be very happy to keep promoting your show.
And we appreciate it. Likewise to you. We'll definitely be fervent advocates for street epistemology and all you've done to promote it. I think it's a very interesting approach. I think it's something that it can grow. Very. And I think that's what I think I enjoy most about it. It is not stagnant. It is not something that, hey, this is the method you have to use. This is, hey, we have a really good method that we think might be working. It needs this. We'll fix this. We'll change this and let it just grow. And I think that's the best possible approach you can have to have these kind of dialectics with somebody. I honestly do. I think it's great.
It would have done me no good to just delete your email, Steve, and say, fuck this guy. Like, how dare he tell
me? Why else does?
That's what I do every day.
I want to listen. If someone's critical or they're concerned about what we're doing or they have a suggestion or they want to endorse it or whatever, bring it to us. We have four different Facebook groups for a variety of different approaches, whether you want to critique it, you want to practice it, you are a theist or you're an atheist. We have all these different communities. We want to hear your voices. We want to get better at it. We want to improve it. We want to look back in 5 years and marvel at how far we've come and how much we've improved it. We know it's not perfect. We have a strong confidence that it's not perfect, we should say. I should say.
Everybody needs. They need more street epistemology.
We want your feedback so we can improve and grow and get better at it and make it an all-inclusive thing that everybody can learn regardless of your belief system.
We appreciate it, Anthony, very much so. And with that, I'm going to announce that we have our first Patreon as of today. I think it'd be Patreon. Yes, patrons, and then it's Patreon. So we have our very first one today. So thank you very much for that. We appreciate all the support that we've had for the Non Sequitur Show channel, including all those that have watched the Arn Ra Hovind discussion. I think that's going to go down as one of the greatest discussions of all time. And of course, there's part two on the way. It's in the works. It shall happen. So Kyle, you made anything you want to announce?
No, just thank Anthony again for coming on. I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. If not, at least to say the word correctly.
We'll all end the podcast by saying the word epistemology. Ready? One, yep. 2, 3. Epistemology.
Epistemology.
Here we go.
Good night, all.
Anyways, we'd like to thank you guys, the listeners, for taking the time out of your day to listen to the show. You can catch us on YouTube as well for this podcast in video form. That's youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Join us April 24th at 6 p.m. That's a Tuesday for another discussion, and this time it's going to be with Matt Dillahunty, a person that he will be having a discussion with. We will announce in the future. Details are still being worked out on that, but we do have Matt Dillahunty confirmed. And that'll do it for episode number 9 in the can. I'm Kyle Curtis. That's Steve McRae. This has been Non Sequitur, reminding you to be bold, dream on, and never hide.